So this evening I'd like to continue the theme that I started last time, which is the theme of practicing with challenges, and particularly focusing last time and this time on practicing with thoughts and emotions, including challenging ones. And these two evenings really connect as well with the talks and explorations from the last time I was here, which was in April, last time I was here, we looked quite a bit at how we practice with challenges, using particularly heart practices, forgiveness, compassion, and so forth. So what I want to do tonight is to very briefly review what I covered last time, and then particularly focus on working with a series of challenging emotions and looking at how we do that. And I'll particularly bring up, anger and fear, okay, which are both very challenging. And we'll also recognize they're less imposing relatives, like irritation and anxiety. So last time I presented the understanding of our practice as cultivating a commitment to being responsive. And it's a very mild-sounding English word, being responsive. Of course, everyone wants to be responsive, but I was suggesting that we could understand this as being a very simple and straightforward way of talking about our deepest commitment in practice, which is to commit as best we can each moment to being responsive, which means being free, actually, and being able to move out of, at least to some extent, our reactivity, and that's what our commitment is moment to moment. We try to be responsive, and all of our practice, all of our training is helping us to be responsive. Some of you know the famous Zen story where a Zen master, I think it was the 10th century, was asked, "What is the meaning of enlightenment?" And you could imagine people getting prepared for what he might say. Great Zen teacher. I think he was near the end of his life, which added a little bit of drama. And he was getting ready to, what should I say? And they would say, okay, it's going to be something about the way that inner and outer comes together in a brilliant display of light and compassionate heart manifesting in the 10 directions. And as we have it with translation, he didn't say that. He only said, what is awakening? What is enlightenment? It's appropriate response. It's very simple, right? And all of our tools, mindfulness, loving kindness, wisdom, study, all of that helps us to give an appropriate response at whatever level the response is called for, whether it's individual, relational, or something to do with our larger world. And so it's a very wonderful handle. And last time I also tried to unpack some of that, of what that means to be committed to responsiveness. Partly it means being committed to working with difficulties and being willing to take challenges as part of our practice. I gave the wonderful Tibetan saying last time, when the sun shines and my belly is full, I look like a Dharma practitioner. But when troubles arise, my faults are exposed. Remember that? And so it's pointing to how we're not just looking for protected settings where we can be kind, peaceful, and people can very clearly see that we're spiritual. And we may wear the right clothes just so they know that more clearly. And so there's another Tibetan saying which says, turn all obstacles into the path of practice. And this is hard, right? But this is our practice. This is hard. You know, we often want to think that our practice will help all difficulties go away. Has anyone ever had that idea? Yeah, okay. Two or three of us. Okay. And yet, this would really be called part of appropriate view or wise view, is that what we're really about is that appropriate response, and that means we're also about being willing to open to difficulties and not just flee from difficulties, but say, ah, something to stretch me a little bit more. Ah, another learning experience. Or as one person whom I know said, there's, I guess, a well-known phrase. I think actually someone I know has it in a book title now, another effing growth opportunity. Right. So we are actually opening to the possibility of learning. And that's hard, right? Because our conditioning is so strong. Something happens that's difficult, and we go into the reactions. We go into the conditioning. And so we want to keep the perspective, something to learn from. And there are multiple trainings that actually help operationalize this, all sorts of things that are helpful. And I think the core of our practice helps us go in that direction, helps us to be able to take everything as learning, to take everything as an invitation to deepen practice. Again, easy to say, but it's hard in practice, right? This is hard. And the invitation is to see if we can stretch in that way. It's like we recalibrate. You know, maybe our initial reaction is, oh, this is happening. Oh, drat. I actually never say, oh, drat, but it just came out as it sounds like something that teenagers would be taught to say instead of alternative formulations. And so we learn how to do that. One of the other ways of framing it that I talked about last time was that we take radical responsibility for our own experience. That's a big one, right? You know, again, and I made the distinction last time, other people and situations can trigger difficult experiences, but they don't in themselves cause it. The causation always involves internal factors. And that we have some control over. We can work with that. And, you know, in the extreme, we know stories of great Tibetan practitioners being tortured and keeping their center, right? And we know that. And they didn't say, well, my practice was pretty good, but once I was in prison, forget it. No, they stayed with us. That's an extreme example, but it may be inspiring. And then we looked at three basic ways to work with thoughts and emotions. I'm focusing on working with thoughts and emotions here, paralleling the use of heart practices that we looked at the other time. And so I generally talked about three ways to practice, we might say, with thoughts and emotions. First, when we feel significantly out of balance, it's actually hard or impossible to practice, and we need to ask, what's happening? Can I really bring mindfulness and skillful means and the RAIN method to what's happening? Or am I out of balance so much that my first concern has to be to come back to balance? You know, much like that instruction taking when we're on the airplanes for the adult to put the mask on first, because the adult has to be present and be there before the adult can help the child, right? So it's parallel to that. We need to be able to be present and practice. We need to have a certain degree of centeredness. And so very vital is to have a whole set of tools for coming back to being present, coming back to being balanced. And we talk together about a lot of these practices. So we could talk about having body practices or, you know, doing exercises depending on the degree of difficulty or the challenge, right? Some challenges we could walk around the block and that would bring me back to balance. Others would take other practices. We can use the heart practices, like loving kindness can often be very beneficial We can have practices that we do at very vulnerable times when we're in a, when we can feel ambushed or assaulted by thoughts, emotions, reactions being triggered and so forth. And we want to have a repertoire of tools. So I might use loving kindness or compassion. You know, if there's a self-judgment, I can go to compassion, and that can often just shift the energy. We want practices which can shift the energy when we're in difficult times. We want to have those. Again, multiple ways, talking with a friend, could be done individually, you know, even sometimes just coming to a community gathering and something can shift, you know. You know, often we say talks like this, you know, sometimes if we get one or two important adjustments, that's great. You know, that's great for an evening, and that can be very significant. So we want to have those ways of coming back to balance physically, using meditative practices, heart practices, talking with friends, and so forth. And then secondly, we can explore thoughts and emotions with our mindfulness, and this is especially where the tool of RAIN comes in. Recognition, acceptance or allowing, and then very crucially, investigation. Really being able to stay with the experience and explore it. And doing so in the spirit of non-identification, just being with our awareness, really tracking what's going on. And I'll give some examples of this with difficult thoughts and emotions in a moment. And then the last area that I wanted to mention is really having a set of another toolbox of skillful means, really other ways to work with challenging thoughts and emotions. You know, and there may be a lot of further tools that we can use that can sometimes they help us go more deeply. They're really further developments of inquiry. Sometimes we need whole sets of practices for anything related to interaction. And interestingly, last time a lot of the questions were about difficult thoughts and emotions in interactive context, you know, which we, and I was thinking maybe I should have that be the topic the next times I come back. Because primarily last time I was focusing on more inner practices with difficult thoughts and emotions. Questions came up because they're on people's minds about how to work with interactions. And part of that would be doing the inner practices, but we would also then bring in skillful speech, a lot of guidelines for relationships which bring in further degrees of complexity. So, so we would have various tools that we could use to work with difficult thoughts and emotions when they come up in interactive or relational context, and various other skillful means. Okay, so that's helpful to think. Here are kind of three basic sets of tools. One, to come back to balance. Second, to be mindful and explore. And then third, the rest of the tools, the further skillful means. So how to practice with difficult thoughts and emotions. And I thought I would talk about both anger and fear, okay? And to give some examples, okay? So first of all, with anger, can be very challenging. We can very quickly be reactive, lose our center, and there's a tremendous value from having this process, particularly of investigation. And again, let's say anger's there and we are out of balance, we are really, really angry, the physiology is such that it's very hard to be present, it's very hard even to be skillful. And that's one of the things that we want to know about something like anger. It's true also with fear, that the physiological reactions can be quite extreme. I think we know that. Psychologists would talk with anger sometimes about being flooded, you know. And I can remember having very significant anger come up maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks ago. And it actually just came up with someone left a message, someone who has the potential to trigger me. There aren't too many of them, but there are a few. Or in that way, I guess there, no, I shouldn't say that. There probably could be multiple possibilities. But there was just a message left on a message machine. And I listened to it, and I could feel myself, my physiology changing in like 5 seconds. And it lasted for about 2 or 3 hours, mm-hmm. right? And we know that when we're in that kind of state, it's actually very hard to act skillfully. Very good to know that, right? And so skill, you know, this is, again, this is what to do to come back to balance. It really is also really how to be skillful. So in that case, my approach was to take a quite a long time out. Right? And again, we would want to have various ways to come back to balance, but we with difficult emotions, it can very much affect the physiology. You know, obviously, with something like fear, it can take us into survival. But anger sometimes is about that as well. Anger is often about some boundary that's important for my well-being being violated, or having a sense that it's violated. So first of all, we want to say, am I balanced? And when it's possible, we can work with mindfulness with anger, which can be tremendously important. And for me, one of my part of what's happened for me in my own history of doing retreats is that I've often had for a number of retreats have had one difficult emotion or thought pattern predominate for 7 days or 10 days. So I've, from the positive side of taking everything as learning, I would say I had wonderful learning opportunities, you know. And I may have talked about my experience with the most detailed one with anger, and I wrote about it in the book some. This was a time when I was on a retreat, and I had actually just moved to California. And I'd been living in the middle of the country and somewhat on my own. And I was very interested in saying what kind of practice really will work in this culture. That was really an important, very important concern for me. And I went to a retreat in San Rafael at Dominican College. This was pre-Spirit Rock. And I had gone probably before that to 15 retreats. But something about the retreat, maybe it was the timing, I felt quite triggered, and I was very quickly angry. And my anger, the content of my anger was, these retreats are making believe that we're like monks or nuns. I want the retreats to really be connected with daily life. Again, I had been to multiple retreats where I had loved getting away from daily life. You know, and loved the process of just going into silent inquiry. But at this particular retreat, something, what should we say, hit me wrong or something, or another way to say it was I was triggered. And I was angry. And I wasn't just angry for a little while, I stayed angry for 10 days, about 18 hours a day. That was the content of the anger. And I went immediately to talk. Jack Kornfield was one of the teachers. I went to him and talked with him. And he said, I actually have some sympathy with your anger. And I didn't tell him this, but I said, well, do something about it. You know, but I didn't say that. I said, oh. And he said, well, you have two choices. You can either stay at the retreat or you can go home. And if you stay, you can explore your anger, and I'll help you, and I'll give you some tools and some techniques and help you with this. So I chose that. And he basically said, keep on looking at the anger. He said that we used a technique that had come from one of the Burmese teachers, Upandita, which was a technique done sometimes in retreats where you take very brief notes at the end of every sitting and walking, maybe just like a line or something. So I did that. I used that technique for the next 5 days, you know, and I would report. And the anger continued. But there was a chance really to use, we could say, that rain process with the anger. And so I clearly recognized that there was anger. I accepted that it was there. I wasn't trying to get rid of it. Luckily, it was really in a workable range, which really helped a lot. It was not like that example of being physiologically flooded. But it was in a workable range where I was quite angry, and it did affect my body quite a bit, but it was workable and I could actually stay with it. So the whole retreat was essentially inquiry into anger. And I had never looked at anger like that. And it's, again, one of the glories possible of this practice is to really keep on looking at these very ordinary aspects of our experience, which most of us have never looked at carefully. And we've often, when anger comes, we have a strategy, to get rid of it or to act out, typically for most of us. And we actually don't look at it much. Same thing with most of the difficult emotions. We actually don't really inquire. And I probably wouldn't have done it very much myself without that retreat, but it was amazing. You know, I could see, how does this affect the body? I could see, you know, there was a lot of fire often. There was sometimes nausea. There was a lot of effects on the body that were quite pronounced. I could see the emotional energy was very strong. I could see what the storylines were. And this is, again, what we want to do, particularly with difficult emotions. I could see what are the primary storylines or narratives, because those are going to be key for keeping us stuck, right? It's getting caught in certain narrative lines. So when we're doing inquiry, we really want to look at that. We really want to see. And so I could really be with the anger and notice what happened. You know, another thing that was interesting was that it took many different forms. And I came out of that retreat saying, anger is not a unified experience. There are multiple forms of anger. Sometimes there was pettiness. Sometimes there was self-righteous anger. You know, sometimes there was anger which, when I stayed with it, moved into sadness. You know, it was like, oh, I'm really sad. I feel isolated. I think I have this important perspective, but I don't feel like anyone's open to listening to it. I could feel sadness, you know, and that could get stuck as well. But I would, the anger and many emotions are in families, and, you know, one difficult emotion can trigger another, and sometimes not just difficult emotions, because when I would stay with the sadness, often I would experience love. And I could experience that truth of how sometimes beneath anger, when you actually look into it, is love, which is, I think, true, for example, of some activists who are motivated by anger. If they would look more deeply, they would find love and a passion for justice. And when they don't know that, the activism gets warped. When they just get, this is my view, when they get just caught up with the anger. So there was tremendous value. One of the guidance, one of the main aspects of guidance I got from Jack was, when you're working with a difficult emotion, watch how it arises and passes. This is a key guidance generally in practice. Watch what triggers it. Watch how it moves and changes. Watch where it goes. And then I could see, oh, wow, I'm angry, but, oh, something's shifting and I feel sadness. And, you know, the way I told the story, it's understandable. It would open up to, oh, I feel no one's listening. I feel isolated. And then it would kind of connect with other parts of my life where I would feel, where maybe the same experiences would have occurred. And I would feel the sadness maybe of sometimes feeling isolated or not heard in other situations, right? And then I could be with that, maybe with compassion and hearing. And it was actually, you know, the retreats were very good places to explore that. And then sometimes I would stay with the sadness and it would go into love, which was basically, or care. I really care about this community. I want it to hear, you know. And that was, that permitted me actually to act. And I've had that other experiences. Maybe like some of you, I've done a lot of work with Joanna Macy. And she has collective processes, which actually have some similarity to what I was describing, where we surface anger, but we let it move. And I've experienced that in the context of being in group settings where there might have been anger for more social situations. And actually being with that and feeling that move into love. And just the whole range of experiences, very illuminating. And it actually, for me, permitted action. When the anger could shift like that, it permitted action, which is crucial, right? For a lot of times, anger is the indication that some value is not being met, or some need is not being met, or some boundary has been violated. And when we're reactive about that, we're not going to act so skillfully. When we can actually be with it and go more deeply into it and feel what's actually beneath it, that there's a deep need that's not being met, or there's a need, there's a love, a wanting justice or whatever, then skillful action can come out of that. So this inquiry, very crucial in many ways. And then I'll just mention one other thing about that, is that one of the forms of anger that sometimes manifested was I felt it as like the energy of the Jewish prophets. And it was a little dangerous, because I was somewhat identified with being connected with the truth. And I would, the anger would take the form of, I represent cosmic justice. You can do what you want, but if you don't follow the truth, you will suffer. I noticed it, right? That was mindfulness. I noticed that was one of the varieties which sometimes appeared. Like I say, that could be misused. And, you know, and in the world is misused. But it was an interesting energy. It was part of what I was experiencing. So you could see in the case of anger, and it was beautiful to have that amount of time. I think in daily life, we may not have 10 days, and we may not have the great benefit of being angry for 10 days in a row. But we can have 2 hours or 3 hours. And then sometimes the work is to keep going back to it. Repetition plays a big role in our practice. It's being with the anger for 1 hour or 10 minutes, 50 times in a year or more, and do it like that. And the same learning comes, but the repetition is really crucial, because what I'm describing took place over, maybe 150 hours of watching anger, right? So it's a lot. I don't know if it was that much, but something was a lot. But we can practice this way for short periods when we work with those tools. And the same thing is very true of an energy like fear. And much of what I said about anger really holds for fear. You know, and fear is actually a very archetypal energy. You know, some of you know Aung San Suu Kyi from Burma says, the only real prison is fear, and the only real freedom is freedom from fear. So again, in its various forms, anxiety, fear, nervousness, and so forth. It's, again, something we can work with. And, again, we want to work with it in these multiple ways. We want to, and a lot of times fear will come and we won't be in balance, right? So what do we do to come back to balance? And we can use all, we can be more physical. We can use the heart practices a lot. You know, if you wake up anxious in the middle of the night, loving kindness is wonderful. And many of you know that the origins of loving kindness in the tradition are traced back to the Buddha giving a group of monks an antidote to fear. Loving kindness is understood historically as an antidote to fear. you can use it in the middle of the night. You have to practice it every day. You know, I remember, I may have told this story a year or two ago, but several years ago I was in Colorado doing a retreat at Taramandala. And I was camping out, and they gave me a campsite, and it was a very nice one. And they said, oh, this is a very nice campsite. And, you know, there was a bear who came through here a week ago. But we found the bear, and we took it 50 miles away. And so in some state of mind or other, I said, okay, I'll stay there. And then went back, the retreat started, and I came back to my tent, which was fairly isolated. The nearest person was 200 yards away. Went back to the tent, 10 p.m., meditated a little bit, started to lie down, getting ready to go to sleep. Thoughts about the bear. They did not stop. There was some anxiety, and because the bear had actually come and destroyed a tent. Luckily, no one was inside. And so my rational mind was saying, yes, but the bear was taken away. Go to sleep. That had no impact at all. And so at a certain point, I said, it's time for metta. It's time for loving kindness. And I sat up, and I started practicing loving kindness for myself, for others, I think for the bear. And the fear continued, but eventually I practiced nonstop for 3 hours. And at that point, I think it was actually the effect of the metta rather than exhaustion, which probably might have been a factor. But at that point, there was no more fear. I went to sleep. I slept totally solidly. And I stayed there for the rest of the retreat, and I didn't think about the bear one more time. There was something about the metta. I don't know. I mean, it doesn't make sense, but that's what happened. So we can use practices which help us to come back to balance. We can, all sorts of things. Again, talking with people, physical practices, all, you know. And then we can also use mindfulness in various aspects and explore the fear. And ultimately, the practices that help shift away from the fear are really should be understood as stopgap measures. We don't get freedom unless we've looked deeply into these experiences. And so we don't want to only rely on that which helps shift us out when we're overwhelmed or unbalanced. Those are very valuable. But we need to have the insight and the exploration of these states, anger, fear, and so forth. So we want to really study fear. I actually have in my study, I have a piece of artwork from the Bread and Puppet Theater from Vermont, which was one of their pieces that they, one of their summer art pieces was called The Story of One Who Studied Fear. I have that on my wall. I really like that. And we have to study fear. We have to really explore it. You're much like mountain climbers. Mountain climbers don't get rid of their fear. They track their fear. I've never been a mountain climber, although I guess I've climbed some difficult places. Probably most difficult was going up Half Dome, you know, on those cable ladders. Anyone done that? That was a little scary because if you fall, you check out your belief in the next lifetime. So, in any case, mountain climbers, I think, know that fear is there and they're comfortable with it and they just don't let there be further reactivity. It's just, okay, there's fear, but I can be with it. And sometimes, you know, occasionally, you know, I think you know from studies that people are much more afraid of public speaking than death, right? Seen those studies, and I know occasionally I have fear arise in speaking, and it especially arose when I was first doing it. I remember the first time I really gave a significant public talk. I was very lucky that I was a little bit like this. I was sitting behind a desk, and it was very helpful because my knees were actually going wah, 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 like that. And occasionally there's some anxiety, you know. But I've seen it enough, so I just notice it. And the key is always not to react or let it take over, right? So, and that's the mindfulness. It's really the tracking. And then we want to study, what's it like? What's it like in the body? We want to really know it well. All of the difficult emotions, we want to study well, especially so we can notice when it comes up. Notice the fear when it comes up. And it's fascinating to explore. I've also had a retreat where I was fearful for about a week, most of the time. Yeah. Now, just for those of you who haven't done retreats, this is not the only thing that occurs on retreats, just to, for what, truth and advertising, okay? That actually wonderful things happen on the retreat. And generally, and even in my early retreats, the retreats were about equally balanced between difficult retreats and really wonderful, blissful retreats. And then after a while, the balance swung towards bliss. But there's no guarantee what will happen the next time. Okay. So there was, you know, I have had chances, but this is really encouraging you. When there's anxiety or fear and it's workable, explore it. What's it like in the body? What's it like in the mind? Especially with fear, there's typically, I think I invented a new English word. Okay, typically. Okay, and there is a storyline, and the storyline with fear is often repeated over and over again. I think we all know that, right? You know, it's like the bear. The bear every 10 seconds. We have our equivalent of that with anything where we have fear, right? You can know that. It's like, it could be catastrophic thinking. You know, this is going to happen, surely. This negative event. Or, oh, I blew it. I'm doomed. Or maybe on a lesser scale. And we want to track that. We want to really watch the storyline, watch the emotional energy, watch the way it's in the body. And this is a significant part of our practice, to really study all of these difficult experiences. It's not the totality of being able to be skillful with difficult emotions. As I mentioned, I think of it in those three categories. There also are a lot of skillful things to do and a lot of skillful ways to be with anger, obviously interpersonally, which I don't have time to go into. And again, I think I'll reserve that for the next time I come. So let me just finish with two. I had some stories, but I'm going to not go into them. More stories that are in some books, but I think I want to leave more time for talking together. And I'll just end with one line from Hafiz, the Sufi teacher and poet and mystic. And the other, a short poem from Rilke. Okay, so this is, let's see where this is, from Hafiz. Okay, well, I don't find it, but I think I remember it. He says, fear is the cheapest house, is the cheapest seat in this house. I'd really like to see with better accommodations. That's Hafiz.
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, fear is the cheapest seat in the house. I'd like to see you with better accommodations. Okay, and the other one is, maybe I'll finish with Rilke. You who let yourselves feel, enter the breathing that is more than your own. Let it brush your cheeks as it divides and rejoins behind you. Blessed ones, whole ones, you where the heart begins. You are the bow that shoots the arrows, and you are the target. Fear not the pain. Let its weight fall back into the earth. For heavy are the mountains, heavy the seas. The trees you planted in childhood have grown too heavy. You cannot bring them along. Give yourselves to the air, to what you cannot hold. So thank you for your attention and your practice and for the community here. So some time for any observations, questions. From last time, some of us practiced perhaps with the RAIN method, and they have some things you noticed, observations. So any observations, questions, and so forth. Veta, please.
With both anger and fear. So with anger, really looked at it, what triggers it, and I've gotten to that level, I know what it is.
Yeah.
And it's true with fear. With fear is an easier one to explain. I'm afraid of heights. I know it's irrational. I've never fallen. I'm not my mother. But I get to a spot. With both of them, the other, of course, is more painful in many ways because it's emotional. It sounds emotional.
Yeah.
I don't know how to get. Do you know what I'm saying? I've looked at it. I sort of know what causes it. But I get there, and it's just I'm stuck. It's so hard.
Yeah.
It's almost a fear of going below the fear or below the anger.
Particularly
with the anger, but both of them.
Yeah, so really talking about having inquired a fair amount, in this case, into anger and fear,
yeah.
And being at a place, and it sounds like there's been some learning, some significant learning, an exploration, but it sounds like what holds you, or where the triggering still has an effect, maybe with both anger or fear.
Like a difficulty to explore.
Feels hard to get there. Hard to get there to unravel it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so how to proceed. Mm-hmm. See, a few thoughts occur. Mm-hmm. One is, of course, the main thing is keep practicing. I bet you didn't think I was going to say that.
In block letters.
Yeah, because it's helpful again to use the model that I went into a little bit of detail last time in about degrees of difficulty. Know that this is very high degree of difficulty, and that all of us have high degree of difficulty situations involving difficult thoughts or emotions that are hard to access. Right? All of us do. And it's, you know, if we didn't, there'd be nothing left to learn. And so, first of all, to know that it's a high degree of difficulty, which means it's hard to get to, it's hard to get at, and that's normal. So it's not a problem per se. Okay. Secondly, keep on investigating anger and fear where the degree of difficulty is not as high. Keep on looking into it.
Mm-hmm.
And then find ways. Sometimes if you can stay with these particular triggers in a balanced way, we don't usually do this in our insight practice, but it is possible to deliberately go into the territory of the anger or fear for the purposes of inquiry and transformation. So, you know, that would be to deliberately spend more time going into what triggers you. For the because the basic nature of transformation is one that you know because you've seen it with other experiences. It's going to essentially be seeing it clearly enough and being with it so that the charge goes away, and you see through something. Maybe it's a self-image. Maybe it's some difficult past that still has control over you. But there's some way that can be brought to the surface so you can work through it.
That's the
It's very helpful to, of course, have someone who can work with you, guide you, etc., on that. But you can deliberately go into difficult territory. Again, it's not usually the approach that we use in insight practice. But you certainly look at the lives of practitioners. And one of the stories I brought, which I didn't read, some of you know, was a story of Achan Cha deciding, I've had enough fear of ghosts. I'm going to go meditate in a charnel ground for at least a day. And he ended up being there several days. And that was terrifying for him. But he decided to seek that out. And I've sometimes done practices where I've sought out difficult experiences. Again, to the point where you can be relatively balanced, not something that would just take you away. So those are a few things there. Keep practicing, and you know, and have all the different tools, loving kindness, and strengthen them. But probably more deliberate inquiry into the difficult area with some guidance, and being willing to go there deliberately, probably.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Please.
This is going to kind of flip the table a little bit.
Okay.
How do you deal? I know loving kindness is a way of doing it. How do you deal with people who are really angry and confrontative and, you know, righteous and constantly railing on about one thing and another?
Yeah.
Without allowing yourself to get sucked in and be reactive or,
okay,
you know, try to just, how do you do that?
So how to be with quite angry people, maybe reactively angry people, skillfully. Yeah. And again, most of the emphasis tonight wasn't so much on how to work with these difficult emotions in interactive settings. And if I would give a full response, I would have had to, I would have to have laid a groundwork, which at least, you know, 30, 40 minutes to do that, and talked about skillful speech. So I'll try to give a response, but I won't have given the groundwork. So it will have limited, hopefully some meaning, but not as much as it would if I could say a lot more about skillful speech. First of all, it's actually very helpful to have worked with one's own anger. It makes a huge difference for being able to be with other people who are angry. Because to the extent that you know it, it maybe ceases to be something scary. If we haven't looked at our own anger, someone else's anger is going to be scary. Okay? And a little bit unknown. And hard to work with. You know, if you've looked a lot at your anger, I think, again, I'll try to give a short response. We have time for other questions as well, because we could take a long time with this. But I think the first thing would be to take care of yourself, make sure that you're okay. You know, and if you're out of balance, do that which brings you back to balance. If you're really out of balance in that situation, a very good strategy is to get out of there. You know, time out. Whatever. So remember the three ways to work with difficult thoughts and emotions, because they're each applicable to interactive situations. So if you're really, if you're just really flooded or knocked into just judgmental mind that's out of control, then probably get out of there. Just cut the situation. You can't really respond skillfully at that point. If you can stay balanced, empathy is going to go a long way. Again, there are all sorts of aspects of a response. What you do internally, being empathic with the other, skillful ways to speak, and so forth. But let me just say a word about empathy. That if you've done your own work with anger, and you see someone angry, and you've done your own work where you know that anger typically covers over other emotions, that will help you not to be so hooked by the anger. You'll know that in your own guts. And you'll maybe even try to tune in and say, what's beneath this anger? You know, can I, you know, even like a, you know, a self-righteous activist, let's say, can you feel where this person really wants justice? It may not be very visible, right? But you can know that something like that is there. It's just taking form as reactivity. And so that's a challenging kind of empathy. You can go in that's advanced practice, right? Can I be empathic? So and you can say, oh, you're really angry because I can really my sense is I can almost feel you really want justice in this situation, right? So you don't go with the triggering, but you go with what's genuine there. And there's always going to be something genuine with everyone. With every difficult emotion, there's always going to be something genuine. You can empathically touch it. And if you can meet the person there, it doesn't have to be confrontational. That's hard. You know? So again, if I would bring that up, I would want to give a lot more to say about that. You know? But that's a short version. Maybe last one, then we'll do the meta cards. Yeah, please.
So for the four types of the brain,
yeah.
The last one on the non-attachment.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or is there some other criteria that you apply that you know you're done with it?
Yeah, how to know that one is following the fourth aspect of RAIN, which is, what did I call it? Non-identification was the language I used. We could say non-identification, which really, we could also say non-reactivity. And so one good way to look and to see if it's there is to know all the different ways that we might be reactive, right? with anger. You know, we might be reactive and saying, I don't want the anger to be here, I want to resist the anger, or it might be to go into the narrative of anger. I'm just right, aren't I? You know? And so it's to be very familiar with maybe the three or four or five main ways that we're reactive. And if we notice they're not there, then we're actually able to be with the flow of experience. Without, you know, like you were saying, the repetition of the narrative, let's say, you know, that person should get therapy, right, or whatever. And, you know, when at first we were repeating it every 30 seconds, now it's not. And I can, if you can basically feel it in the body and notice the thoughts and not be reactive, that's a good sign that you're working with non-identification. And actually, another way that you can know is that you actually have interest. You're not trying to get rid of it or manipulate what's happening, but you're actually interested in exploring. So interest and curiosity could be a sign of the non-identification and the inquiry. Yeah, well, great question, thank you. Let's do the cards now, and then we may have a little more time for questions, but we wanted to move to the cards.
For 13-year-old Zoe, who has lost her mother, for Kathy, who died last Sunday after a long battle with cancer, and for her husband, Gordon, both great friends of the Dharma.
Mm. Thank you. So we do have a little more time, probably you know another 5 minutes or so for, please, Isabel. Right?
I have a question actually about, and maybe you don't want to answer, but I'm really curious about, it's kind of related to her question, that when you got done with that, like how did you know you were done with the anger after that retreat? And like, did it just dissipate and you felt like you looked at it enough? And when you're looking at it, what exactly are you not identifying? And so that's easier for it to let go. And if that's too personal, it's fine, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, so questions about, was there some sense of completion with the process? And when I was actually in the midst of being with the anger, what was it?
How did you work your way out? And what was the benefit of going through all that?
What was the benefit? How did I work myself out of that? I'm happy to talk about it. First of all, it wasn't like, okay, I'm done with reactive anger. Doesn't work like that. On the other hand, there was tremendous learning, and it was incredible to, I had the sense of having looked at something carefully that I'd never looked at carefully. That's very intimate. in a way. It was like a part of my experience. So I felt there was tremendous benefit. I also could feel, you know, like partly related to the earlier question, it really helped me tremendously with empathy. I could really have a sense, oh, this person's angry, I know that. Oh, and I especially knowing that there's something beneath it that's driving it, that's actually could be something beautiful, right? Even if the anger doesn't look very beautiful, right? That was very, very important. So it wasn't a sense of completion, but there was a sense of having learned a lot. And certainly being much more skillful if anger would arise. And like I say, this was a little unusual because the anger was always in the workable zone. Degree of difficulty probably, you know, I mean, maybe occasionally it was 9 or 10, but mostly it was probably in the 6 to 8 range or something like that. And so it was workable. I could really be with it without getting too stuck. And I could notice the reactivity. And there was insight. I could also, a lot of compassion came, you know, because I could really see, you know, there's also personal insight to really see how the anger was connected with sadness, maybe where some of my needs weren't met, or where I felt lonely or isolated, and I could see how that connected with other experiences. So there was a lot of personal knowledge that came out of the exploration, and to, you know, because you go into anything deeply, and it sort of takes you into your psyche. You know, where a lot of things are interconnected. Yeah. Did that get at the response?
Yeah,
thank you. Please, yeah.
So what happens when you're hit with the 10? I'm thinking, really, where are you going? What are you going to do with it? I mean, I'm thinking mainly fear, because anger, I've developed a lot of ways of taking time off.
Yeah.
That's really, my practice has helped me there. But sometimes, fear, it'll just punch it and I can't take the time out.
Yeah.
There it is, and there are all the repetitive thoughts and the brain cancer already metastasizing all through my body, and et cetera.
Yeah. Well, what to do with a level 10 that is there and you can't avoid it, right? That's really what you're asking?
Yeah.
It's just, it's there. Well, all of what we've talked about, you know, if it's there a lot and it's like an ongoing situation, I would definitely do a lot of metta or whatever heart practices sort of keep you in balance. Right? Do all sorts of things which bring you into balance. One person who I've studied with, some Michael Mead, says that beauty is an antidote to fear. You know, so do that which personally for you is an antidote. You know, I work with one person who experiences a lot of fear, and you know, for this person, what we find ourselves coming back to over and over again is actually being in nature, being with beauty, being with that which is calming the nervous system. Something like Qigong would be wonderful, that which calms the system, because a lot of this is happening with fear as well as anger on a physiological level. If it's something which is one time, you can do these things. If it's something that's repetitive, that's coming a lot, you know, maybe related to a regular feature of your life, then maybe work with someone around it, focus on it. Sometimes some aspects of fear may be connected with trauma from the past, especially if you feel it on a bodily level. That can be, you know, that sometimes needs to be attended to specifically. Watching the storyline, I think, as you're suggesting, is a, you know, for some of us, that would be the main guidance for the level 10. Watch the storyline, don't feed it. Watch the catastrophic thinking or the negative storyline that I'm hooked on. Identify it, know what it is, as much as is possible. Do not repeat it. Just say, cut. You know, cut, I'm not going there. And if you need to be aggressive with it, that's okay.
Say, that's helpful because I don't really have this. My ongoing fear is declining a lot, but
yeah.
Every once in a while you get the big hit.
So these are temporary. temporary visitors.
Although as we get older, you know, they get more challenging.
Yeah, great. So those, you know, that those would be some good ones. You know, that's, you know, the person I was thinking of, those are the main ones we work with. You know, the nature, that which brings a calm and even pleasure to the body, because it's so much on a bodily level. Notice the thinking, calm the physiology, and sometimes get support from others, whether friends or even, you know, professional in some cases. Okay, I'll finish with a poem, and then I'll do just a short metta. This is Pablo Neruda. If each day falls inside each night, there exists a well where clarity is imprisoned. We need to sit on the rim of the well of darkness and fish for fallen light with patience. So, feeling the quality of metta in your heart, this kindness, this wishing well for self, for others, starting where it's most accessible, maybe toward yourself, maybe towards an animal or a child. Wherever it's accessible, feeling this kind heart. Letting it start radiating out in front of you, in front and back, left and right, above and below, filling up our hall here with the quality of metta. Wishing well for everyone in this hall, the heart radiating out in all directions. And then moving out into the world beyond the walls here, in all directions, without limit, left and right, front and back, above and below, radiating out from the heart, wishing well for all beings. And wishing that our evening may benefit each of us, and then in known and unknown ways benefit those in our circles, and beyond our circles benefit all beings in the world. So thank you for your kind attention, and look forward to the next time I'm here, which I believe is in 2 or 3 months. So thank you in advance for all your support.